This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Hey everybody, this is Richard Deitch and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producers are Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry. Guest this week, as we continue to do this podcast from self-quarantine in Toronto. First off is the Boston Globe sports media writer, Chad Finn. He has been on this podcast many times. And we discuss our thoughts about the NFL draft and whether what we saw can be incorporated in future drafts, which would be, I think, phenomenal given how engaging this draft was. But a certainly something that Chad and I are not sure the NFL will do, given all the revenue that comes from taking the draft to another city or to different cities, and you know, the celebration that they can get from people who are into the draft, you know, 500,000 people in Las Vegas, pomp and circumstance, etc. So Chad and I discussed that. We discussed John Oran's piece of the season starting later and the Super Bowl starting much later, the coverage of Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski in both Tampa and New England, and the national interest now in the Tampa Bay Bucks because of those guys, and then some just COVID-19 stuff on the sports media. Chad is followed by Adam and Craig Malamut, who are the creators of the fantastic BR animated series Game of Zones. That series has its four-part finale coming up beginning on April 30th, and those guys are just immensely talented. If you are an NBA fan, you've probably watched Game of Zones, which is sort of a medieval takeoff on Game of Thrones. Just phenomenal stuff. Think of LeBron James as Jon Snow. And we get into just basically why this became so popular, how the shows get created. It's just the amount of work that the Malamut brothers do to put this this really just entertaining and fantastically smart animated series up. So Chad Finn first, followed by Adam and Craig Malamut on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, Chad Finn has been a guest on this podcast many times. He is the sports media writer for the Boston Globe, but also covers a number of New England sports as well when they let him sort of go out there and become a columnist. And Chad Finn is back on the Sports Media Podcast. Chad, how are you?
I'm good, my New York Canadian friend. How are you doing?
I'm good, yeah. Oran could not, he's probably doing another podcast this week, Chad, so I had to bring you on basically as America's podcast guest. John Oran is doing something else, so we bring in.
Sometimes I get accused of that, but he does like five times as many as
I do.
He does.
I know.
Yeah, and he's A-list for sure.
Yeah, he's it's A-list. We're all A-list. We're all G-list. So I want to, you know, speaking of, the reason I brought up John is because we're going to be talking about a story that he did this week that is certainly very germane and interesting to us. But let me first start with the NFL draft, Chad. I wrote a piece for The Athletic on Monday, which you know, sort of offered my thoughts on the draft. I talked to a lot of people behind the scenes at ESPN. You know, for the technical challenges, Chad, that they had heading into this, and I think for expectations of a broadcast that might have been, you know, that might have just been stilted, or a broadcast that just might not have been what we're used to because of the fact that everybody had remotes at home. I mean, I don't think it could have gone off better. Yeah, there were some things that were that could have been improved, et cetera, but man, one, I think it was a great broadcast, and two, I think more importantly, I think they discovered something that's workable for the future, and that's going to be interesting. Can they incorporate some of this stuff into what's generally been a, you know, a mega event, you know, sort of a larger-than-life event? How did you see what you watched? How did you process the NFL draft over the last couple of days?
Yeah, I think there's some irony there, I think. I guess it's irony, maybe coincidence. But this was going to be the grandest of all drafts. You know, they were going to have the prospects come over in what, gondolas of boats across the, I don't know, a fountain or moat or something in Las Vegas to meet Goodell. And it was going to be over the top, even by NFL draft standards. And instead, they get something that felt really authentic and real and relatable to people who are sitting at home with their family members watching this, because it was a constant reminder that whether you're a sports writer sitting at home trying to figure out how this is going to come across, or a football fan, or someone who's about to have their dream realized and become an NFL player, you're all in the same situation there, just sitting there waiting and watching and enjoying this broadcast. And I have the utmost respect for the way ESPN pulled it off. Seth Markman, I thought it was really telling that Fred Godelli tweeted out his experiences in the producing the draft. I think he did it 13 to 14 times before he became the guy running the operation. It's Sunday Night Football and the number one television show in America and all of that. He kind of pointed out on Twitter how difficult this was and how much respect that people should have for what Markman and ESPN pulled off. And I think that's absolutely true. They did a great job with it. The complaints are all minor. There's some lag time, I think, with Lewis Riddick's camera in particular. You touched on that today in your piece. Some of the over-the-top stuff with backstories of the players, it started getting to be a little much, almost to the point of it felt like a Key and Peele or Saturday Night Live parody when the poor guy, I think it was Gross Matos, the kid from Penn State picked by Carolina, they talked about his father drowning, saving him, and then his brother getting hit by lightning and killed during a Little League game. They didn't really tell us who he was as a player before they're telling us this horrible backstory. And I know they wanted human interest, but I don't think they quite realized how the draft itself this year was human interest. So overall, I give them a solid A.
There's a lot there, Chad. That's a very good description of sort of the whole idea that this draft was probably the most accessible draft to people than we've ever had, because it's all relatable because you're in your home as well. I saw something that you may have sent out on Twitter. It was Twitter. Yeah, it wasn't a piece that you did. And it was the idea of, maybe the NFL should not go back to the drafts of the past. And I would agree with that 100%. The problem, of course, and we both know this, is there's a lot of money and revenue to be had when you travel to one of these cities like Nashville or Las Vegas or Philadelphia to get you get 500,000 people part of an NFL experience. It's a massive marketing tool. The networks love being on site because it's branding for them. So do you see any way where they can incorporate what we just saw in this 2020 NFL draft while the reality still being that there's going to have to be some part of the NFL that's in one of these cities?
You know what? I know they've talked about implementing some of this and that there was some sort of lesson learned here about what's appealing about the broadcast and the draft and what isn't. I don't think they end up implementing any of it, though, Richard. The stuff that was most likable about this was Brian Flores, the Dolphins coach, having his kids around and high-fiving his kids after they picked Tua, or seeing Cliff Kingsbury's whatever planet is his house is on, Belichick and his, kind of pretty basic setup in Nantucket. It's the peaks inside these people's lives. We're not going to be able to get that. They're all going to be back in their war rooms at Gillette Stadium headquarters whenever we're allowed to do that and it's safe to do that again. So I don't think they can work that aspect in at all unless, they tell Brian Flores, bring your kids to the headquarters next year. We want to put them on TV or something like that. So I think that element's gone. And the other part that, you mentioned, it's a huge television show. It's a huge production. It's a major moneymaker for ESPN and for the NFL. And they're expecting 750,000 people in Las Vegas for this draft. And that's money they're not going to get back. And that's money they're going to want in the future, whether they're in Las Vegas in 2022 or Tampa Bay, or if it ever came to Boston or whatever, they're going to try to maximize their profits on that. So they're not going to lose that element of it either. So I really don't see, as great as this was, what they're going to take from it to add to the draft in the future, because there's just too much money to be made by the way they used to do it.
Yeah, that's my fear as well. I really like this broadcast, and I think it's interesting. I think it's compelling and watchable, but I'm with you. I don't know how they're going to give up the, you know, sort of the real revenue and real marketing tool that the draft is when it goes to these cities. But we'll probably, both of us will probably be writing about that as they head forward. I know the behind-the-scenes people at the NFL Network and ESPN love this draft and would love to have parts of it repeated. You know, you just wonder if that is repeatable. Another NFL story, and this from the aforementioned John Orand, that I read over the last couple of days that was really interesting, are these contingency plans by the NFL to push the schedule back in the event that municipalities will not open up because of COVID-19, or will not allow, you know, stadiums to be used in certain cities, which is certainly a possibility given the hotspots that exist around the country or in some NFL markets. And so John Orand and make sure I have this right, and Ben Fisher reported that the NFL was looking at a Super Bowl that kicks off on February 28th, potentially a regular season that could start as late as October 15th. No bye weeks, no Pro Bowl. I want to ask you, Chad, when you saw that, what you think of that in terms of sort of a media play? I think obviously the network's going to have to figure out what to do until October, but you know, it'd be interesting. How does a CBS or a Fox or an ESPN, would they be happy with no buys? I don't think ESPN would be happy with no Pro Bowl. Would the Super Bowl broadcaster, can a February 28th date work as opposed to a first week in February? How do you see all this stuff?
I think it's all pretty fundamental and obvious changes right now. If you go through that list of things that they're considering doing, and what's really the first proposal. I think we all realize it's probably going to be even more than this, and that depending on how long the pandemic lasts and when it's safe to go back to arenas and when fans are comfortable doing that in huge groups again, it's probably going to be well past February before things feel completely normal like they did, you know, 3 months ago. So I've got some skepticism about this, Rich, that it's going to be as simple as they set it up right now. But if you get on that list of, you know, things they're possibly talking about, you know, October 15th start date and moving the Super Bowl back to February 28th, 3 weeks back, and you know, eliminating the Pro Bowl, which, you know, everybody but television executives probably fine with, because pretty good ratings, but it's not exactly something you look forward to as a sports fan or anticipate. All this stuff is fine, and it makes sense. It feels like the first snowball, you know, going down the mountain in an avalanche, that it there's going to be a lot more to it than this. And I think NFL is probably going to be as resistant to any league as more than any league in terms of cutting games from the schedule. I don't think they would want to go to a 12-game schedule, or, you know, you look back 1982 when there was the end of the strike, they only played 9 games if it ended up being like a half a season or something like that. They're going to be very resistant to any changes to the length of the NFL schedule. So I feel like this is just sort of the tip of the iceberg, to use a cliche, and that it's all very reasonable, but it's probably not going to look anything like this once it's set.
Chad, how do you think the audience will process the potential of NFL games with no crowds?
I don't know. Is that going to be the first time we see games without crowds? I mean, Major League Baseball is really, you know, it's really pushing to have some sort of setup in Arizona. It almost feels desperate with them at this point. And I wonder if we see Major League games before the NFL season comes back. I'm very skeptical of that as well, but Rob Manfred is certainly pushing forward with this, and the owners are going to push forward with this. So I think we see baseball, there's a chance we see baseball games with no fans before we see the NFL with no fans. And I don't think it would take that long to get used to. I think it would be really, really weird at the beginning, probably even a little bit eerie. But after a couple of weeks of watching it would just sort of become the norm and something we would adjust to, sort of like, you know, how we've adjusted to being home for the last 6 weeks.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, but I think initially I think it'll be a little odd for, and I should have said as opposed to audience, just like a television audience, watching that. But I think people will be so happy about, you know, sort of getting live sports back that they'll adjust to it. It certainly would be, it'll certainly be a big adjustment for the players regarding the sport. And I am with you, obviously, just given the calendar. There's a chance that this starts with baseball before the NFL. But again, you know, we're dealing with different municipalities, different shelter at home restrictions, different philosophies with governors as to when states are going to reopen. So there's so many moving parts of this. But that's one that would be interesting to me just because it's obviously the biggest sport in the land, is if the NFL had to play games with no crowds, sort of the challenges for television and sort of how the audience would process that. So that's one to pay attention to. I did want to ask you, given where you are, Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski have gone to Tampa Bay. It now makes Tampa Bay, Chad, one of the, I would say, top three most desired teams for NFL media outlets to put their games on. The Cowboys are always going to be first, but then, you know, I feel like the Bucks are in that same conversation with the Packers and the Steelers and the, you know, the rest of the teams that all these networks want. What's your sense of how of the interest in Tampa Bay this year nationally, beyond Tampa and beyond Boston?
Enormous. I mean, you know, obviously my view is a little bit skewed because it's all we write and talk about up here right now, but it's going to be huge. I mean, Tom Brady, there was a perception, and I know at The Athletic you guys dealt with it too, and everybody at every newspaper and sports radio show and every sports media outlet in the country, when this began, the question was, what are you going to write about? What are you going to cover in sports? And we had one of the biggest sports stories in the last 25 years here in Boston, if not more than that, with Tom Brady leaving after 20 years. You know, it's an enormous story, and it's one that obviously is hyper-focused here because of what he did as a Patriots quarterback, but it's also an extremely relevant national story as well. And I think we're going to see that in the NFL schedule and how relevant Tampa Bay all of a sudden becomes. I mean, they've been an okay team the last couple of years, and you know, Jameis Winston was an interesting player, number one overall pick. Mike Evans is a great player, and Bruce Arians was a great character, but they didn't register at all. They were not relevant. They probably haven't been since John Gruden was their coach, and now that's going to change by about, not 180 degrees, but probably about 150. And Brady did that, and Gronkowski joining him just changes it even a little bit more, ratchets it up a little bit more. Locally, we've been trying to find out whether Fox is going to show their games every week up here, because for years and years and years, the NFC team that got primary attention in New England was the Giants, because before the Patriots launched in 1960, the Giants were New England's team. It was the closest thing you had to a local team. It feels weird to say that about a New York team, but there's still a lot of old-timer Giants fans here. And now you have to figure that the appeal by far is going to be Tampa Bay in this market. So I haven't gotten any answers from Fox about that, about how they're going to approach it locally, but I imagine we're going to see them a lot more here in Boston and nationally as well.
Chad, this is a Boston-based question, but will the coverage of the Patriots subside at all without Tom Brady or Rob Gronkowski, or would the media contingency still be the same? And probably, I mean, I guess my natural sort of thought would be that it certainly stays the same this year because they become a very, very interesting team with this massive transition post-Brady.
I think a big part of it is how they fare, how well they do it, assuming there's a relatively normal NFL schedule. You know, if they're 5-11 Patriots, the interest is going to wane enormously. I mean, the Patriots traffic blows away Red Sox traffic, Celtics traffic, Bruins traffic. Boston was always a baseball town. It became a football town at some point during this dynasty, and it stayed there. And there's obviously going to be some changes. You hear from fans now who sort of have lost perspective that want to credit Brady more than Belichick for the success and think that the Patriots have done. And I actually wrote about that today, sort of citing all the things Bill Belichick did that had nothing to do with Tom Brady that helped build this dynasty. But I think that some people have already sort of forgotten about that. You look at the history here. This thing started in 2001 when they beat the Rams in that first Super Bowl. And entire generation of Patriots fans, if you were 8 years old then, you're 27 now, and you don't know anything other than Tom Brady and Bill Belichick winning and winning and winning. Your idea of a slump is that stretch from 2005 to 2013 where they were great but didn't win a Super Bowl. So some people are going to get a little bit of a dose of reality here, and I think it will start to affect the traffic and the attention they get if the team struggles. But I'm one of those people who think that Bill Belichick's actually being a little bit underestimated right now. He knows things that Patriots fans and football fans don't know about the roster that he has. I think they're going to be pretty good and still remain compelling as long as he's here.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
One of the things, Chad, I got into a little bit with John Oren last week was the long-term impact of the coronavirus on the sports media. And I think one of the things that seems very, very clear is that there's going to be a lot of jobs that are lost during this that won't come back. It's the same for so many other industries that have hit the United States. And perhaps it's just a consolidation in some sports media entities, and maybe like at a place like ESPN or Fox, less remote broadcasts where they continue to call more games from their headquarters as opposed to sending production trucks, broadcast trucks out to live events. Just off the top of your head, Chad, sort of free-forming a little bit, how do you think this impacts our world 6 months, 12 months from now?
Wow, yeah, I mean, I want to know what the world looks like 6 months from now, because that's still the, you know, that's the mystery. And 6 months from now is also the election down here in the United States. So that may change a few things or keep some things the same as well. So it's just, I can't remember a time in my life where so much was up in the air about our future. And how that impacts sports is, obviously pretty far down the list of relevant things, but those of us in the toy department, you know, also recognize that this is going to have some long-term impact. I think we've seen a lot of some places use it as an excuse, what's going on as an excuse to sort of pare things down when they were already doing that. The Boston Herald got it, its staff up here, its sports staff and some other reporters, but that was sort of the way they had been going anyway, and there are other places that are trying to do the right thing, but the advertising revenue just isn't there right now because every business is shut down, and more or less every business is shut down, and so they're scrambling to keep their staffs supported while the money isn't coming in the door. So it's just such a tenuous time and such a scary time and so uncertain that I think you have to judge it so almost by an individual basis of looking at the way, you know, the New York Times has handled its sports staff compared to the way ESPN has done things and taken pay cuts with executives and its top 100 highest paid people. Everybody's sort of approaching it differently, and I'm skeptical to cynical about the way some of them are doing it because they're trying to, you know, they're doing sort of dastardly things that they've already done before. But I feel pretty fortunate myself. I mean, the Globe here has had a full sports section every day and, you know, smaller paper, but we haven't had a hard time filling the sports stuff with a lot going on. And the response we've heard from people is overwhelmingly positive. It's thank you for giving us a distraction rather than why are you writing about sports in a time like this? I think we saw this with the NFL draft. People are happy to have that little bit of sports in their lives right now.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, and that we can end on this. That's really interesting to me because obviously the Athletic obviously is not morphed from sports to something else. It's a different publication. It is a sports specific publication, but you know, we're producing as much content as we ever had before. We're getting very sort of creative in terms of how to tell stories when there are no live games going on. And I actually think the site's been phenomenal. I mean, it's just, you've seen stories that we probably just didn't have the time to do. But that's interesting, and I appreciate what the Boston Globe is doing. And that's not to knock the New York Times or the Washington Post or any other place, but you know, I think to me, I would have used the creativity and the brain power and the passion of my staffers to do interesting sports related stories that they never had done before. And many of those stories can certainly relate to COVID-19. But they, you know, they made a decision, and I understand it. They want to put their resources elsewhere, but I'm with you. I'm glad the Globe did that. And that, if I was an editor, that would have been my, I think, thought was to let's do some work that maybe nobody, would have expected us to do, including stories on the nexus of sports and COVID-19.
Yeah. It's interesting with us because the first week we had a Zoom meeting, or we talked with our editor, Matt Pepin. Sports editor Matt Pippen, and the editor Brian McGorry is super supportive of the sports department, and sort of built that backlog of stories that are lists or historic things or things you can run evergreen at any time, just to make sure we had stuff. I think the first week I wrote a Sunday takeout on the five best games in the history of the four major sports teams here. It's a space filler, more or less. People read it, but it's a space filler. And it's turned out we really haven't needed a lot of that. I mean, we had Brady leaving, which is a content gold mine. We had Gronk coming out of retirement recently and leaving, which is probably the second most popular Patriots player of this stretch. And he's closer to Brady than most people would think, just because he's such a gregarious personality. We had Chris Sale having Tommy John surgery at a point when people weren't supposed to be going to the hospital. Marcus Smart had COVID, I think he was the last player actually to acknowledge publicly that he had it. And we had the Bruins not wanting to pay anybody. So there are stories directly related to the outbreak, and there have also been stories that are just sports stories and major sports stories. And we really haven't, in these 6 weeks, lacked for anything. We've run a lot of those type of stories. Now, I wrote about being an old pickup basketball player, which is something I never would have written during any of this, but the feedback and the response to this sort of thing is it's really good. And I know The Athletic has done a lot of those same type of stories as well. And I think either the historic stuff or the personal stuff, people really are enjoying that. But the interesting twist is it hasn't been that necessary, because they're really, without sports, there's still been a lot of sports to write about.
Yeah, and again, certainly in your neck of the woods, you know, the Patriots are the gift that keeps on giving, because they have been a gift that is sort of given to North America. You know, we at my other job for Sportsnet, I mean, Tom Brady basically gave us 2 weeks of content, so we appreciated that.
Oh, it's unreal.
We appreciate that very much. Chad Finn is the Boston Globe sports media writer. You can also follow his non-sports media work at the Boston Globe's website, as well as but you're in boston.com as well, Chad, are you not?
Yeah, both. We run our Globe stories on boston.com as well, so all over the place.
Anything else you want to promote or plug? I feel like Letterman here before I let you go.
Man, I'm just taking it day by day. I don't know about you, but nothing specific coming up. I've got a piece on The Last Dance. Talked to Jason here, but everybody's been reading about that. He's a Boston guy, so we'll be doing that. And have a Zoom call with the president of Celtics today, so he must be super bored. So just day by day.
Jackie McMullen wrote a pretty good story in the Boston Celtics chat between the 2008 team that sort of, you know, lasted 12 years with Garnett and Doc Rivers and Paul Pierce. It's an interesting little story.
Yeah, those guys, I mean, they were the ultimate. That 2018 was the ultimate. We can beat on each other, but you better not dare give us any. The ultimate big brother, little brother thing. And it's interesting to see Ray Allen sort of be shunned from that group because he left. That was a really compelling basketball team.
Yeah, interesting. I agree, even if he didn't weren't in Boston. All right, Chad, always great to catch up with you, man. And I'm sure we will talk soon. Be safe to you and yours. And thanks for joining me, as always, on the Sports Media Podcast.
Thanks, man. Good talking to you. And I hope all continues to go well.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Adam and Craig Malamut are the creators of the fantastic BR franchise, Game of Zones. The final season drops April 30th in what they are billing as an epic four-part finale. Now, for those of you who don't know Game of Zones, my sense is that if you're listening to this podcast, most of you do. But for those of you who don't know Game of Zones, it's an animated video series that imagines what real-life NBA drama would be if you sort of placed it in a medieval Game of Thrones-inspired universe. I think of LeBron James as Jon Snow. Might be one of the easier ways for you to wrap your head around that. And Adam and Craig joined me on the Sports Media Podcast. Guys, thank you very much for coming on today.
Sure. Thanks for having us.
Oh, our pleasure.
Adam, let me start with you. I'm not going to go into sort of how this series started. You guys have told that story before, and it's been on a million podcasts. I really want to try to do as much currency as possible, because I think the people who are really into this series will want that. So let's start with you, Adam. What can people expect from this four-part finale? How just in terms of storyline, is it like contain like the middle of the NBA season until the stoppage with COVID-19? Do you sort of fantasy it and pretend what would happen? Can you give us a little sense of what people can expect?
Yeah, sure. So one thing is that always expect the unexpected with Game of Zones. So that's one thing, is that we're always trying to do new things and keep things interesting. I think one of the reasons that we're finally wrapping up after seven seasons is like we've explored every medieval basketball joke we can possibly explore. And what we thought was interesting for this last season was to finally do what we haven't done, which is a storyline that kind of threads throughout the episodes. And that may split our fans a little bit, but it's kind of like come full circle from being like just a one-off viral video with a bunch of little vignettes that just mashed up Game of Thrones to like an actual original storyline that still has aspects of Game of Thrones. But this is the first time we've ever tried to do like a continuous serialized plot. Even though it's only four episodes, that's surprisingly difficult when your entire universe doesn't make sense.
What about you, Craig? How do you sort of see it?
Yeah, I would add, in the past we've parodied single episodes of Game of Thrones, and this time we're sort of taking elements from a whole season of Game of Thrones. And one of the interesting things was that we wrote the whole season before the whole coronavirus thing went down. So it'll be interesting for fans. A lot of them will assume we wrote it after coronavirus started getting everyone, sheltering in place. But we wrote it before, and it actually, I think, holds up pretty well. We had to rush to work from home, and luckily our animation supervising producer Chris Wallinger was able to set up a giant virtual animation studio, so all of our team is working remotely. But we wouldn't really have been able to record anything new from our apartments, or at least I wouldn't have, because I don't have a great audio setup here. And so, we had to improvise in a way, and I think we managed to dodge a lot of news bullets. So I'm looking forward to seeing how people react.
And we're on schedule. We stayed completely on schedule, so that was pretty impressive.
Nice. Craig, I'll stay with you. How did you determine that the last season would be four parts as opposed to 12 parts, one part, 16 parts?
I think that One thing was we wanted, well, so Game of Thrones went from like these longer seasons, and then like the last season, I think it was like 6 episodes or something like that. So, you know, we kind of mimic them in every dimension, it seems. I think that the four parts was, fans, they are always asking for longer episodes. And so we kind of just, I think, wanted to change it up and see what it would look like to give fans beefier episodes rather than a lot of small episodes, so they can sit and really sink into the storyline a little bit more rather than chopping it up. And, you know, as Adam was saying earlier, we like to change it up a lot. So I don't know if, Adam, you have anything to...
Yeah, Adam, did you have anything other?
I would just add that also 8 episodes, a lot of work for us. Like, we obsess on these things. And even though they're silly little cartoons, I think what gets them to the quality that people watch them and go, that was better than it should have been. Like, that was better than I expected it to be, that stupid little cartoon, is because we like obsess on these things and it takes a lot out of us. And doing 8 episodes every season, even though only 5 minutes, was just a lot of work for us. And so we wanted to lessen it a little bit and be able to do it right rather than being like scrambling and packing. It was just, it was a lot on the pipeline. And this allowed us to do 4 episodes well and longer and really craft something special, as opposed to we felt overloading us a little bit to do another 8 episodes. So,
Adam, let's stick on that obsession. One of the things that I think is really just unbelievable about this is the amount of detail and research that you guys put into this is clear. Not only do I think, are you aware of NBA storylines, like real-life NBA storylines? You will go so far as to throw things in the background of the animation that an NBA fan will be like, oh, wow, that's really cool. And I'll give you one example if I'm wrong about this, but I think somebody noted to me that in the trailer for this last season, in Giannis's like headgear, there's like a raptor or like a little bit of a, like a, like a, like a, like a, some kind of something that signifies the raptors are in Giannis's head, you know, obviously based on what happened last year. So the point is that you guys go really, really deep, it feels like, when it comes to the research in this. Can you just give me a sense of what it's like for you and Craig and the rest of the team? Like, how do you go about researching this so what we see on the screen has a lot of connections to reality?
Sure. So there's two parts there that I think of. One is the what you referenced with the claw marks going across the head of Giannis. And that was and it's funny because that was the story behind that is that we write, one of the things that makes it so stressful is that we're writing these things. We have to write these things well ahead of time. And then by the time the playoffs come, the storylines can change. And like, we were writing this scene about Giannis being the new king of the East. And meanwhile, the Bucks and the playoffs were happening and the Bucks Raptors was happening. And we're like, we don't know what to do. And so when the Raptors won, we had to show that in some way we acknowledge that. So we put the claw marks across his head. And then we just kind of had that be permanently in his head on the helmet. I will say that it was really, what's nice about when we are thorough about all the details is that people start to see things and meanings and things sometimes when it's not even there. And I think like the idea that the Raptors are in Giannis's head is smarter than we are. Like that, when you said that, I'm like, yes, that's right. That's what we did. And it was more that we just kept his helm the same. But as far as researching and all that stuff, you know, Craig and I don't look at ourselves as basketball experts. We look at ourselves as like funny little storytellers. And our skill is to extract the funny and interesting from what's going on. And what's nice about being at Bleacher Report is there's tons of basketball experts and fans of every team. And we are obsessed with not getting things wrong. And so whenever we have a scene, if it's a Bucks scene, if it's a Celtics scene, we talk to the Celtics experts. We say, hey, what player's right for this role? And we interview the people, the experts in our office on different topics. And like when we did an episode about called NBA 1K, which was about NBA 2K, the game, because we knew there's such a following. And so we brought into our office the people who we know play that game. And we just talked through every little little detail. So that way, when someone's watching it, they have the feeling like that it comes across as though whoever made this is an intense fan of whatever this, like, we wanted to come off like we're super fans of whatever topic we're doing. And we do a ton of, when we did the, yeah, like the Bucks scene with Jason Kidd, we just went deep into Bucks research and talked to Bucks people. And so we always want to come across as authentic. I was like, so little things always bother me, and I feel like little things can distract and pull people out of things. So we try our best to keep it airtight. And then Craig, you could probably speak to the Easter eggs a little bit.
Yeah, we have this process. We started evolving as we kept making this. And early on in the show, we would like occasionally throw, oh, wouldn't it be funny if like in the background you'd see this little detail? And we saw that the commenters were like catching all of these details, because you're no longer watching on TV. You're watching on the internet, on like YouTube, and there's a comment section. And so if 1% of the audience catches a joke, they can broadcast it to everyone else. And pretty soon, you know, there was this feedback loop where we're like, okay, if they're catching these, let's put some more jokes in there. And, you know, by like season four, we're putting like a million book titles in the bookcase behind Mike D'Antoni. And there's like commenters writing out every single book title and discussing them. And so we just kept at it, and our process evolved such that we would, in every stage of the process, add another like coat of paint of jokes to where we could. So in the writing, and then in the audio, and then in the storyboards, and then, you know, with the background artists. And yeah, pretty soon it became so dense that I think a lot of people have to watch it several times to pick everything up. And that's fun for us to see everyone trying to scour our cartoons. It's like a highlights magazine or something.
Craig, how many people work on this in total, from you two to all the extended staff?
Well, it's so the core production team is a staff of a little over 20 people, depending on our animation needs. They grew from it was originally just Adam and I doing everything. We had Adam's friend would do the storyboards, but we would write it, voice it, and animate it. And now each of those parts of the process, we have true professional animators and artists that can do those things. So everything's been upgraded. We have storyboard artists, we have background artists, designers and animators and compositors, which the compositor will put all those things together and put special effects on it. And we have several producers who are incredibly helpful and have just been a game changer in allowing us to level up the show and make it what it is today.
You know, Adam, one of the reasons, obviously, that this caught on is because Bleacher Report, you know, it's a very, very big entity. They're going to put promotion and marketing behind it. And in a sense, you can't make something good, but in a way, you could sort of make something a hit if it's at a big place. Now, all that said, one of the things that's interesting to me is that the sort of NBA, you know, you want to call it sort of NBA Twitter or Twitterati, or, you know, sort of the people who are really into sort of social media and sharing, and the NBA has a great fan base when it comes to that. They really adopted this and, you know, sort of like got very excited when new ones drop. They talk about it on Twitter, etc. Can you just, from your perspective, Adam, give me a sense of when and why you think this became popular? Was it a slow growth, or was it something, was it started to be shared by some influencers? What made this really popular on NBA Twitter, which it clearly is today?
Well, I think initially it was just a combination of a few things. It was the first thing you mentioned, which is Bleacher Report has like crazy distribution on social. And then we made a piece, which was the first Game of Zones, that just resonated. I mean, Craig and I didn't expect anything with the first episode. We submitted it to Bleacher Report, and then we, like, I think Craig went to go play Frisbee or something when it went up, and then I was doing something. And then all of a sudden, it just blew up. Like, it went crazy viral. And I really just think that was just a combination of distribution and sticky content that was, you know, it was NBA and it was Game of Thrones and it was relatively well made, and it was during NBA playoffs and Game of Thrones premiere. And to keep it relevant now, I would say that our episodes now don't go as viral. They are now just, they get bigger numbers, but that's just because there's a fan base and there's a programming plan and all those things. But what Craig and I think about, and what we noticed, is that the heart of the conversation was happening on Reddit, and it was happening on the NBA subreddit. And so we spend a lot of time there, and we get people like the way their commenting works with its where it's ranked, you know, you really there's so many funny comments, and you really get a good sense of like how NBA fans talk and what they think is funny. Like that to me is where we get a good sense of fan culture. And so we kind of got fluent in that language. And then when we write, we can hear the voices of the echoes of the commenters in our head and get a feel for what they'll like and what they won't like. So I think maintaining a connection to RMBA and those voices as our fans when we think about making this is a big reason why I think it resonates across social.
Craig, is there a particular NBA player that you enjoy animating and voicing the most?
I think I enjoy voicing Kyle Lowry the most because I mean, his personality is already more of a fun personality than I think most NBA players, but I also made his voice one of my like favorite British accents to do. So it's sort of like, what does he say? Like, no, he's my friend. You can't have Norman or shush Norman. And I feel like it would be my natural British voice if I was a British person. But I mean, there are a lot of characters we do at this point, and it's hard sometimes because we have to, we only have so many British accents we do, so we have another dimension that we can multiply those accents by, which is pitch shifting our voices lower. And I also do LeBron, and LeBron I always had trouble with because it was always one of these more generic accents I was doing. But over time, I feel like his character has become like this very complicated character in our show because we feature him more than any other character. And I think he's like been the most dynamic, and he definitely in this season continues in that character arc, whatever it is that we've been improvising as we go along. So that's been a lot of fun too.
I'll ask you, Adam, in a second for yours. Craig, have you ever heard from Kyle Lowry or LeBron James on these?
I haven't heard from LeBron James. I do know that the Raptors are, as a team, have watched their DeMar trade episode, and it was Danny Green, I think, had mentioned on his podcast that he had showed it to Norman Powell, and Norman Powell was cracking up because, like, I think that, like, we captured something about their locker room chemistry that might have rung a little too true for some of them. We had heard through the grapevine that the Raptors staff actually thought that we had someone on the inside, like listening to what was going on. And that is not true.
That's I live in Toronto, so that is equally hilarious for me. Adam, what about you? Are there particular NBA players that you voice that you really love doing?
I feel like a connection now to James Harden to the point where I expect him to talk like Oberyn when he's interviewed at the NBA games. I expect him to say, like, oh, you know, it was a great game. I saw many ducks, and so I decided to draw fouls, you know, and things like that. I expect him to talk like that. And so there's that. I like any character with a Eastern European accent because I find that there's just the comedic timing with that accent is always funny. So it's like, so many wins, you know, we're going to get so many wins. But in the deeper version of that, which is Vlade Divac is fun, which is, foxes are smart. I drafted the Aaron Fox. I thought he was a fox. And then there's also Thoros of Mir, which is Dame Lillard's character, which is like, Thoros of Mir. Oh, yeah. We're the Brotherhood with one banner now. So those are some of the characters that I like.
I love that. Have you, I guess, ever heard from Game of Thrones people, Adam? Either actors, creators, NBA fans who are part of the Game of Thrones universe who cross over?
No, just their lawyers. No, I'm just kidding. They never came. I'm just kidding.
That was my next question.
We've never heard from the lawyers. Thank crossing our fingers. But we haven't really heard from anyone on Game of Thrones. On the first episode we did, I think their official Twitter tweeted it out. But I haven't heard from any of the actors. I don't know how much crossover there is between Game of Thrones and the NBA, although I know what's her name was at the game between the Rockets and the occasionally they show up at NBA games.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Daenerys. So no. Yeah, was the actress who plays her was at that game. I remember that. That's right, because they the NBA made a pretty good ruckus about that, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's good. There you go. All right, there's one crossover. Yeah. It's Emily Clark, Amelia Clark.
So right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For me, yeah. I know. It's just I was trying to think of an Eastern European country like Romania. It was too early in the morning for my brain to work as well.
Yeah.
You ready?
Showtime on May 3rd. Summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
All right. A couple more here. We'll go back to you, Craig. And maybe you finished this stuff beforehand, but... every guest that I've had on this podcast, certainly in the last 7 weeks, obviously their lives have been dramatically impacted by COVID-19. And I wonder for you, Craig, did the completion of this series, was it impacted by this? Because just at a very base minimum, you know, you can't go into an office to use whatever editing equipment, technology, you know, that probably is housed at Bleacher or wherever you guys work out of. You're essentially, you know, WFH, you're working from home and you got to figure it out. So has COVID impacted the production of this, or was it done prior to March 1st, let's say?
Yeah, it has impacted the production of this, but we're still on schedule, as Adam was saying. It was really interesting, though, as things were starting to grow. We work out of Manhattan, which is obviously like the hottest hotspot in the U.S., if not the world. It was in March, and there was a week where we had heard rumors that the office was going to close down, and it seemed like everything was starting to shut down. Schools were starting to shut down. And so I had to do some audio work for the final episode, but Adam was able to work from home. And then out of nowhere, the NBA, you know, was suspended. And that next day, I was planning on going in to finish recording all of my lines for the last scene, which I had to do in the office because we have a soundproof booth there. And they shut down our office and they said no one's allowed to go in there. Everyone has to stay at home. And I basically walked to work that day. It took me like an hour, and I didn't want to take the subway, and I'm like holding my breath as I'm walking past people. At this point I'm thinking like anyone could have it. I don't know. And I came into the office and I just like recorded every single line of the last episode because we had just written the script, and saved it all on, you know, the Dropbox, and then I bolted, and I threw all of the recording equipment I could into a duffel bag, and I just like took a cab home because I couldn't carry it, and then just hoped that I didn't have to re-record anything, and got super lucky that all the takes worked, and I was able to stitch all the audio together from home. But that was a scary moment. But once we crossed that, you know, like it was smooth sailing because everything else was easier to do remote.
And then on a personal note, Adam, I'll take just you. What's it been like for you? You're in, as Craig said, you guys, I think, are both in Manhattan. You're in Manhattan as well, Adam?
I'm in Hoboken now. So
you're
was
in Hoboken.
Manhattan.
Okay, yeah. So you're
close.
You're outside of that. Yeah, so, I mean, again, we have listeners sort of from all over the country and Canada as well. What has your experience been like being, you know, sort of at the edge of the epicenter?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I worry most, our father's a physician, and so he's at the hospital, you know, he's dealing with the PPE issues. And so, you know, for us, what we try to focus on is just making sure that, you know, everyone, life kind of has changed for everyone and it kind of sucks. And like, we're just like, let's just give them a really good cartoon. I know that sounds like stupid, maybe silly, but like, that's what we can do. Like what we can do besides, you know, besides any ways that we can donate and help is we're thinking, let's just make this good so that people can have, because we're not getting a lot of content, new content right now. It's a lot of stuff shot from home and whatever, you know, people, one thing is that you can make is animation, but animation takes a long time. So we're fortunate enough to be one of the few things that can actually maintain its schedule and come out like normal. And so hopefully, you know, this cartoon can give people something that's fun and feels new, you know, amidst these crazy times. But for me, this is, I think like everyone, it's scary and you just try to do the best, you know. I like, for me, living in an apartment building, every time I go to take out the trash or go to get a package, you know, I put on a mask just to walk into my own hallway. So there's a lot of weird new things happening, but hopefully Game of Zones can provide a few minutes of escapism.
And then Craig, we'll end with this. What is what's next for you guys, if you're indeed working together? The BR series will end, and then obviously I'm sure you guys want to move on and do new projects. Where do you think your sort of professional path will head next?
I think the first thing we're going to do is take a short vacation. I guess we're not going to go very far. We'll stay in our apartments. We Adam and I, as Adam was saying earlier, you know, we've made a lot of medieval basketball jokes. We've also just, you know, we've been doing sports cartoons for a really long time. We were doing a couple seasons of The Champions, a soccer show, and you know, before that we had other shows like Sports Gods and things like that. And I think we want to try just something outside of sports, like covering topics that, you know, don't expire in a few months or a few weeks, depending on what the, you know, latest storyline is in the NBA or the NFL or Champions League. We really like history, and we like philosophy, and we like science and politics, and you know, we'd love to be able to write stuff that comments on current events. I think that, you know, we're gonna just kind of start banging our heads together and thinking about what kind of show or thing project we want to get involved in that allows us to explore those interests. And I don't know, Adam, if there's anything you would want to add to that.
Yeah, I would just say that, like, things about just society and people. And I think also, like Craig said, the challenge with sports is, like, you know, and how long animation takes, is that you write a joke, and the joke is about how this player's sucks, and then that player starts playing well and your joke's ruined and you put all this time into it. And so that doesn't happen with original characters. So I think doing something with original characters, rather than having to rely on our main characters being actual people who can change and who have feelings and who can do things that, like, maybe they do something illegal and then you can't put them in your cartoon, you know, which has happened. And so you know, that's always been a challenge. So I think I'd love to do something where the voices that we love to do are for our own characters and not necessarily James Harden.
Adam and Craig Melamed are the creators of the fantastic BR franchise Game of Zones. That final season drops April 30th in what BR is billing as an epic four-part finale. Guys, I really appreciate it. Again, as someone who lives in Toronto, I could not get enough of the Kyle DeMar storyline. So great. I still laugh about it, basically. Even I'll be laughing about it 10 years from now. You guys have created a really, like, a pretty magical universe, and congratulations on that. And I wish you guys nothing but the best of luck as you head forward. Thanks so much for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast, and best of luck with the final season.
Thank you, and thanks for having us. Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Thanks, Richard. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
All right. My thanks to the Malamets for an interesting conversation, and of course to Chad Finn. If you are interested in this kind of content, head through the archive page where you'll see our last five or six episodes. John Orand was, as I mentioned before, our previous guest, talked about the NFL draft, at least day one, the last dance, and some other sports media matters. Prior to that, Sean McDonough of ESPN discussing his time on Monday Night Football. Kalen Kaler and Joan Neeson, former Sports Illustrated workers, talking about their experiences leaving SI to Maven and where they hope to be heading forward. Chico Harlan, the Rome Bureau Chief of the Washington Post, what is it like to cover the coronavirus in Italy, which at one time was the center of the universe for this awful virus? And prior to that, Scott Van Pelt of ESPN, who talked about putting on SportsCenter during the time of COVID-19. Head to the archives. Hopefully you'll see some stuff that you're interested in. And please, if you like this, leave us a five-star review and a comment on the podcast. That's how it continues. I want to thank everybody at Cadence 13 for their hard work during this. Chris Corcoran, Spencer Brown, John McDermott, and of course, Sean and Patrick. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.